Debbie Berry.
Here.
Dan Moore is absent. Two members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And I need a motion to approve subject any amendment to minutes for reading on July 27th.
So moved.
Second. It is done. Financial report, please.
Thank you. We are looking this morning at July's financials. As we go through, the full packet obviously is in your packet, the full report is in your packet. As we go through these, we will start as we always do with property taxes, which has a huge negative variance, which I warned you about last meeting. That is a timing issue from when the county was able to close out their first reporting period. We have this past Tuesday, we did get our August advance, and it's been made up for. So it is totally just a timing difference on that one. Local government donations, gifts, and grants. Again, a large negative. But again, if you remember last meeting, we keep going back to last meeting, we did a major budget transfer for the Tiger Funds. And that transfer, major budget adjustment for the Tiger Funds. So because we increase the expenditure side, those funds have to balance out. We also have to bump up the budget side on the revenues. So that's a good $7.1 million of that. We've received some major receipts on the grant front. We have other large ones that we still have coming in. So again, it's a timing issue on that. Interest income's looking good. Keep monitoring Fed rates. I'd love to be excited about this, but rates are still relatively small, even though they are inching up slowly. Charges for services is down slowly, is down slightly. Again, golf is starting to come back from the deficit that we talked about last meeting, but they're still under where we thought they would be for this time of the year. The bright spot, again, is a lot of the enterprise divisions, especially the beach house. The beach house through July has already exceeded their revenue expectations for the year. When we put that budget together, we weren't sure where we were going. It was a best guess estimate, and it's just surpassed all of those estimates. So those are our bright spots there. We have several other areas that are well beyond where they should be for this point of the year. The 55th Street Marina is already at 90% of its budget, and several of the concession areas are already at 90% of their budget, and that was through the end of June. So they still have the full month of August that would be reporting, making up the rest of the year on that. Damages and fines, continuing to monitor. And the self-funded, as with the expenditure line below, as we have been saying, claims are coming in lower than they had been last year. We're in the process of working with HR and determining whether or not we need a budget adjustment on this.
Excuse me, can you go back to the damages and fines? Just
absolutely.
Just explain how does we budget a number like that?
Again, it's a best estimate at the beginning of the year. So it's an estimate of the fines that will be coming in, of any revenues that we'll be getting in for damages through the course of the year. And then we take that budget number compared to how the revenues came in last year and time it against that.
Just curious, how does that trend over 3, 4, 5 years? I mean, is it pretty
yes, it is, absolutely. It's not like we put a big increase in this year or anything else, yes. We are very comparable. I can certainly go back and get you exact numbers on that, but yes, very comparable. There was not a big increase this year. It is a new category this year, although line items have always been there. The grouping of some of our revenues, when we redid the system, we grouped back more into more financial groupings.
And it's all negative things, correct? It's not like someone paying for a pavilion or something.
Correct. It's not like we want to go out and generate income, exactly.
Right,
it's
right.
Funds, it's damages, reimbursement for damages, those kind of things, yes. Okay. So as we continue to move down, revenues in total obviously are showing a negative variance because of the property tax variance. So $7 million there has already, or $9 million there has already been taken care of, and the grants. So we will be looking better next month then because those property taxes will be trending a little bit better at that point. As we work down to expenditures, salaries and fringes, positive variance here. We are continuing to monitor open positions. We're currently monitoring about 40 open positions. So we continue to watch this. and make sure that our expenditures are matching what business actually is. When things are rainy and slow, if we can cut back on that, on the personnel costs, we are continuing to watch all of that. Contractual services. This is higher than we would have projected for this point of year. Obviously still under budget though. We are continuing to monitor this. If we do need some adjustments through the end of the year, we'll be coming back to the board, but at this point we think we will still be okay.
What do we attribute to this?
A lot of it is timing too, where a lot of the contractual services that the contract is entered into earlier in the year and paid at the early in the year, the maintenance contracts, things like that, where it's paid at the beginning of the year, but we're receiving the benefit over the course of the year.
These don't cover capital.
This is not capital, this is just operating, correct. Self-funded again, oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Okay, self-funded again is the workers' comp, the hospitalization, so we are continuing to monitor that. And operations, we have over 90 line items that fall into this account. We are trending very positively. A lot of the major positives in this area, as we have talked about in the past, are the utilities, the water, the sewer. We have uniforms that fall into this category. Membership falls into this category. Training, supplies, all that kind of fun stuff. So again, the positives are definitely the water and storm sewer, the natural gas. Some of our minor equipment accounts, some are training accounts. All of those are showing very positive trends for this point of the year, and that's making up that very positive variance. Again, total operating results, that negative basically is because of the revenue. So of that $15 million that's showing as a negative, we have nine, almost $10 million that will be taken care of because of property taxes. And we know that another $7 million is just Tiger alone in that. So we have those, that helps explain that. Some of that is very absolutely timing. If we keep moving down and look at capital, we are continuing to monitor all of those capital and all those capital projects. There are over 300 projects that we are talking about that have a budget or activity during the course of the year. So we're monitoring all of those, and as those are getting paid, we are they'll be posting here and showing here. So a lot of this is timing. Again, budget, when that PO goes in, the full budget gets put into place, and therefore the budget is showing up there. The expenditure comes as those are actually paid. So unless there are any questions.
Good. Thank you. All right. Hi, everyone. We have a robust group of general action items. The very first one is honoring John N. Kroc, Natural Resources Area Manager. I hardly recognize him this morning without his hat. And his normal, he's still wearing a green shirt, so he's still got that cover. So we can still identify him anyway. So, Derek?
Just like to congratulate John on 31 years. John is gentleman's gentleman. He has got the highest integrity, honesty. He's not unwilling to tell me when I'm wrong. So John's contributed so much to our deer management program, our prescribed fire program. He actually served as a fishery biologist for a while. Came up under John Kasson, knows wildlife like nobody else, and has contributed a lot to the park district and the care of its natural resources, and has represented the park district really well for the public. And the one thing I always got from him too is he says he works for the park managers, not with the park managers. He thinks that's the most important way to get the contact to the public. So congratulations, Sean, and you've done a great job. Thanks.
Well, I know it's a testament to John and his service. Almost his entire crew is here, recognizing him for his more than 30 years of service. And on behalf of Anthony G. Russo, the Board of Park Commissioners, we would like to give you this resolution recognizing your years of service to all the staff and all of the wonderful invasive plants that you've had to manage during your career. Congratulations. What would you like to say? You get to talk.
Been an honor to work for this organization. I started in 1973 as a seasonal, and over the course of that time, I left for a few years for other positions. But I came back, finally got a job at the park, and I was very happy about it. And during that tenure, I worked with a lot of unique individuals that work for this organization. And I think that's really the core of this organization, the people that work here. And like John Kason and John Gerlach, the forester that used to work for the park, I worked with him for many years. And all the park operation managers, most of the names are all gone now because of no one in this room really knows who they are, Bob Hill and Brett. So, you know, but I had the privilege to work with all these people, and I'm very grateful to work with that. I learned a lot in the interaction. And the tremendous resources that the Metro Parks has, the plants and the wildlife that were preserved.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 3 of recognizing John Kroc for his more than 31 years of service to Cleveland Metro Parks.
Move approval.
Seconded. We're all in favor.
The next action item we have is the authorization of a land acquisition. This is the Newman property. This is in Millstream Run Reservation. This is approximately 4 acres of land. This is a strategic piece of property based on its proximity to Millstream Run Reservation, the east branch of the Rocky River. It's something we've identified a number of years ago. Our team was able to successfully negotiate with the Newman family and work on the purchase agreement to secure the 4.9 acres of land.
That's all along the river there too, right?
Correct.
Move approval.
Seconded. We're all in favor.
The third action item is the second reading and adoption of the sustainability policy. I'll turn it over to Rose just if there are any further questions before we roll into that.
We've had no additional comments or changes since the first reading. So pursuant to our bylaws, we are eligible for a vote at today's meeting to adopt the policy and then put it into effect immediately.
Recommended actions on page 4.
Move approval.
Seconded.
Change order number 1. This is for bid number 6284, the 2017 asphalt pavement improvements. My computer advanced itself all the way to the end of the agenda. Apparently, it was speeding through it, so I have to roll back to it. So this is, we're working on the upper 40. This is a much needed area. We have worked to secure a grind and overlay in that particular area, and we're also working on the North Chagrin, the redo of the Strawberry Lane pulling into where we have done all the dredging and all the work in the ADA accessible fishing docks. So those are the two change orders relative to revising the contract in the amount of $158.85.
Just curious about the functionality of the upper 40 drive now.
We're going to do it in two phases. That's a great question. We've actually looking at the analysis of the structures that are currently on there. Yeah. We have one current life estate, one family is still living in one of the homes.
Yes, this is Simic.
Simic. There's Simic, Pierce, and Merkle.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's the ranch house on the left.
It's the promontory.
Mm-hmm. On the left part of the drive. So our goal was, that is probably one of our worst trail connections going down the Foster's Run.
Yeah.
So we're going to grind and overlay out a portion of it to look like all-purpose trail. We'll leave the other part as we look at the evaluation of those.
Okay. You answered my question.
As the structures look to be either rehab or demolished. And then once we finish that, then either we'll take out what's left and then put back.
So focus on pedestrians who still have access for
vehicles. Correct. We also don't want to damage the pavement after we put it down.
Yeah.
And then Strawberry Lane is just to clean up that entrance to the park coming in North Chagrin.
Thank you.
If Dan were here, I would say east side.
You'd say that.
It's a critical reservation.
Move approval.
Seconded. All in favor.
The next recommended action is change order number 3, contract 1409, Parkwide demolition contract. This is actually a piece of property that was presented to us through the conservation fund at the Acacia Reservation. We've agreed to preserve. They've agreed to donate. We agreed to pay a little bit of the property cost to remove the structures. The balance will be provided by the Conservation Fund. We do have the change order secured in the amount of $19,142 to remove the structure and add it to the Acacia Reservation under the same terms as the Conservation Fund has provided the Acacia Reservation.
So the demo is contingent, or the gift is contingent upon the demo as well?
Again, to make a green space in a consistent manner with Acacia.
Move approval.
Seconded.
The next contract amendment is RFP 6243 Red Panda, 643B. Red Panda Snow Leopard Exhibit, Construction Manager at Risk, Guaranteed Maximum Price 2. Sean is ready to go.
Good morning, Commissioners. When we were before you at the July 27th meeting, we brought forward GMP 1, which is associated with the site work for the Asian Highlands exhibit. That work has commenced, and you'll see some of the product of that work yet this morning. So GMP 2 then includes all of the costs associated with construction of the entire exhibit, which again has yards for our Ammer and snow leopards, and then also holding associated with snow leopards, and then also a yard of holding associated with the red pandas. Lisa, can you bring up the price summary, please? So in GMP 2, what we've been able to do is secure pricing relative to all the different scopes of work. They were all competitively bid via Higley, so there are subcontractors associated with the 23 different bid packages. When we were before you on the 27th, we expected the full GMP to be between 4.6 and 4.9 million. So we're here this morning with a GMP of 4.854 million. Then this will encapsulate the entire project and allow us to construct such and hopefully be done in spring of 18, hopefully by the first week of June, we will be complete. Any questions?
No.
Okay, I'd like to thank the Zoo Society, the partnership, the team at Metro Parks, and the team at Higley to bring this project in at the price that we were looking to spend for the increased habitat for these particular animals. And we'll be doing the official groundbreaking today.
Yes.
Seconded.
All in favor.
The next is an amendment to just the professional services contract with Valley Parkway as part of our obligation as the local public agency, the LPA agreement. We needed to have a construction engineer provision for the federal grant money. We needed to use QCI as the quality control portion of it, and this is an amendment to the contract for $35,980 to provide those services to meet the requirement of our construction inspector. Recommended actions on the bottom portion of page 9.
Move approval.
Seconded.
The next one is the award of RFQ 6271, Hinkley Dam Modifications, Professional Design Services. Sean, did you even sit down?
No, I didn't.
You just nodded. You nodded.
Yeah.
All right. Take it away.
Good morning again. We were before you on May the 26th and June 15th via a workshop in May and an info item in June to talk about the Hinkley Dam and modifications to the dam. And in those discussions, which were fruitful, I think we talked about the various potential in terms of what we could do to meet the requirements that ODNR does require for modern design standards of the dam itself. So we've done a preliminary study, we discussed that at the workshop and the info item, and now we are at the point where we can bring on the engineer to then complete that study and make final recommendations to then move forward and work with the contractor to price up the work associated with that final study and then move towards actual construction and modifications of the dam. In that vein, we publicly advertised for professional design services for the dam, and we received 6 responses back, all very well-qualified firms. We interviewed 3 of those firms, Michael Baker, Tetra Tech, and Rizzo Associates, all that came with very high qualifications. We decided, or are recommending, that Michael Baker be ranked the most qualified. And with that, one of the reasons we did that is Michael Baker has a tremendous amount of dam experience, not only dam experience throughout the country, but dam experience in Ohio. Recently, in the past few years, this doesn't list all of them, but they have worked on 8 different dams just in Ohio. This list is of dams they've worked on in about the last 5 years in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And What we really liked about what we saw from Michael Baker was the similarity in project types and scope of projects. You see here, we've got everything from $1 million to almost $38 million down at Buckeye Lake, which is just for phase one. So a good range of design experience and actual project experience. When it comes to dam engineering and working through the permitting process, the relationship and the knowledge procedures that ODNR has from the design consultant is crucial. So we felt that Michael Baker, with their experience, is the best qualified here.
Sean, is that local staff, or do they have a national group of folks that are coming in to evaluate?
Yeah, I would call it a Midwestern staff, in that those who will be doing the primary amount of work on this project are actually not based in Cleveland. Steubenville, Columbus, and Pittsburgh. And we've got staff who, actually it's the same staff who has worked with ODNR on all of these projects who will be working on this project. Exactly. It'd be nice to have a Cleveland-centric firm, but as we saw who responded to the RFQ, we just don't have that, which is fine. So we're very comfortable with Baker. That being said, they brought forward some ideas that John Kilgore and I have been tossing around, which were kind of music to the ears. So very quickly, we've got 150-foot concrete spillway, another 750-foot of earthen embankment. And what we talked about during the workshop and the info item was looking at alternatives to lessen the cost. And they, in the interview process, actually brought those alternatives forward. So reducing the amount of overtopping protection, maybe raising the embankment. This is something that Commissioner Moore actually suggested, so it's one of the things we're going to study. And then another piece of the puzzle is potentially looking at reusing the existing spillway structure and rehabbing that, and then anchoring it with post-tension anchors. So these are the things that we can study in this final study before we go into construction documents, which may end up saving us a good sum of money. That being said, they will save us money in time. This is a quick photo of what those rock anchors and the whole geotechnical drill rig would look like. So one of the first steps of Michael Baker's proposal is to perform geotechnical analysis, which we would do actually in the plunge pool here, and then up all along the earthen embankment as well. So with Michael Baker's proposal, we've got a $226,000 fee for this portion. This does not include the construction documents. This is the final study to get us to being able to make that informed decision on the final avenue we'd like to take, and then prepare the construction documents. So we would come back to you with the fee associated with preparation of the construction documents.
So the preliminary design report, that's really the heart of the...
That's the heart of the matter, but to get to the preliminary design report, we actually need to do the geotechnical investigation, all the due diligence associated with that, which is a notable sum of money, because performing geotech on a dam is not something that everyone can do. It's a pretty specialized operation. That being said, we do. We'll actually drill it and then immediately fill that boring with a grout, because we do not want to create a piping effect where we would have seepage. And the other interesting piece here, and one that we're doing that will probably save us money in the long run, is we're going to install two piezometers underneath the dam that will actually monitor vibrations, so we can get several months of data to determine just how deep, if we do rock anchors, how deep those need to go. So we're getting good information, paying about $6,000 more for it now, which could help us on the design by saving money, where we can not over design and have too great of a safety.
What is the timeline to get through this process?
We will be through this portion of the process by March. And then we will return with a cost associated with design.
Great question. Dialogue, recommended action falls into a portion of page 11, and contract with Michael. The next one is the award of RFP 6260 Beakley Lake Dam Modifications. This is bringing the construction manager at risk on board. This is part of the process to help put the cost together as we're moving forward versus doing it in separate boxes.
Thank you, Brian. So, to Brian's point exactly, having the construction manager on board at this step of the process is crucial in that they are a partner in the team and working with us as an owner and Baker as a designer in real-time costing what these potential solutions could be so that we don't do a whole bunch of design work and then find out that we could have done it cheaper or that we're way over budget. So bringing on the construction manager now, as we found in many of the other projects that we've delivered construction manager with, is the right thing to do. That being said, we again publicly advertised for these services. We received 7 responses back. Again, we're humbled with the quality of firms who are responding to our request for qualifications. We shortlisted 3 in this instance, so Beaver, Great Lakes, and Rulin, all of which have great experience which are applicable to this project. After we went through an analysis of their proposals and an interview process, we ranked these, and this ranking is based on a best value score. So I want to walk you through this because it is very specific as to how we do this. So what you'll see is on the best value scoring, Great Lakes scores first, or ranks first, Beaver second, and Rulin third. What you'll also see is in these numbers, today there's a difference of about $213,000 between the Great Lakes price and the Beaver price. And what is important to note about that is that the price that's listed there is a sum of their upfront fee for pre-constructions, general conditions, and their fee. So Lisa, could you scroll down to the table below this? Thank you. So the components of the price that's listed in the table above is, again, their pre-construction fee. So that's the cost to help us through the engineering process, to do the estimates and to perform and prepare the guaranteed maximum price. So that's what, if the recommendation is approved this morning, that's the cost today that we are incurring and committing to. Then the general conditions and the CMR fee, those are multipliers of the cost of work. So when we come back to you with the GMP, that's when we see these actual costs in the GMP. But one very important thing to note, and that's why today, yes, you'll see that there's a difference of $213,000 between the recommended Great Lakes and Beaver at $543,000, is when you do site civil type construction with a general contractor such as this, they self-perform a vast majority of the work. So they have the equipment, they have the trades, they have all of the resources needed that they can self-perform 95 to 98% of the work that occurs on these projects. So one thing that's very important is that we analyze the self-performed work overhead profit markup. And you can see here that there is a stark difference between Great Lakes, who is proposing a locked 6.1% markup on that work, and Beaver, who has a floating 10 to 12% markup on that work. So when you multiply that against what is a fairly large size project such as this, there is a notable difference. So what we then do is correlate these differences in their overhead and profit markups into the qualification portion of the score. So that's why you see in the table above that the qualifications are lower.
So that's predictability.
It is predictability, and it's also an analysis of the true impact of these proposals on the project at the end of the day, not just upfront. So there is a break point in where Great Lakes would ultimately become cheaper on the job. That's somewhere between $3.4 and $5 million, depending on where this threshold would take effect. And you know, that's one of the analysis that we go through when determining best value here for the construction manager at risk. Aside from that analysis, Great Lakes has performed projects almost identical to the Hinckley Dam project. Not only are they located just a few miles from the site with their entire yard of equipment and their resources, we've had great experiences with them on the Cable Stay Bridge, on the Towpath Trail. They're a partner in ODOT Lakefront West in that they constructed the roundabout at Edgewater Park and performing very well for ODOT, which were, again, a part of that project. And we have an understanding of comfort level and their ability to perform at Hinckley Dam.
Do you have any insight as to why even their pre-construction is so diverse across the three? I mean, the lump sum price?
So what we've seen with this delivery model and in this realm is that some of these firms think of it as, we would bid this project if it was on the open market competitively bid, and that would all be lost time.
So it basically sunk time. Okay. So some of these firms look at it not as a loss leader, but as something they would be doing anyhow if it was competitively bid in the open market as a hard bid project. So, and that's likely the way Great Lakes is looking at it, maybe the way Beaver's looking at it, and then ruling kind of through the whole kitchen sink.
Like they're charging for all those hours and they're putting that in the package.
Correct. And that's pretty consistent with how we've seen these projects come forward is a lot of these firms were almost, it's not a lost leader, but they look at it as some time they would have spent anyhow.
Right, right.
It's part of their overhead as a company.
Versus, I mean, I guess the concern would be they don't think they need as many hours to get the work done or they're not going to be as attentive over time.
When we do see fees that are low, we have very serious conversations about the expectation of if we need to do 10 cost estimates,
right.
Are you prepared to do 10 cost estimates?
Good, thank you. That's helpful.
Yes.
You say that like you mean it.
We really mean it, yes. We don't want to have issues down the road.
How did you, I mean, it's just interesting that you do go into this level of detail, though, with the markup. Is that just experience? I mean,
with a
wrong once and realizing that.
I wouldn't say that we've done it wrong once. With every project that we're doing, we always learn something. I mean, I hope we think that we're good at this, but we are still learning. I'd say that the Metro Parks is probably leading the pack in Ohio when it comes to site civil projects using construction manager at risk. It's only a few other agencies in the state who are applying this like we are. It's been relatively successful. And
yeah.
As we do these, we learn these questions to ask and items to analyze, and in this case, it's very important.
Yeah, that's great, because it could have made a huge difference, obviously.
Yeah,
so.
That's great.
Great question and dialogue. If there are no further questions for Sean and the board of the team, that recommended action falls in the middle page of 14.
Seconded.
We'll move to a tabulation of award and bids. We can provide a usage report for our phone and data services, our pavement markings for 2017, Whiskey Island fire suppression system and ADA docks at the lakefront reservation. We were able to secure after a long set of dialogue with the Office of Emergency Management through FEMA from Hurricane Sandy to get the upgrades, needed upgrades to bring it up to code. That is that one. And then the Rainbird Irrigation Control System is pre-working for phase three of the Seneca Park Golf Course.
Second.
Approval of payrolls and voucher.
Thank you. Before you is resolution 1708111. All of the following vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code.
Seconded. Yes.
Yes.
Good morning. And anyone else who cares to speak?
You have succeeded in promoting the Metro Parks as an event site as part of Central. The over-the-top media buys show how expensive that is compared with promoting the park as a natural break from the rat race decompressed destination. Excuse me. As with technology, you must keep upping the ante lest folks become jaded. The brain acclimates quickly, so it takes more speed, more violence, more whatever to grab eyeballs. Look at the thousands upon thousands you've poured into performers, sound systems, enhancements, and more. If people associate park visits only with being amused, then they will be unlikely to return, experience, and enjoy the natural surroundings, which are the real reason for Metro Parks to exist. Food and drink, concert venues, sporting events, all exist elsewhere, and you have to compete with them. Try less noise and more nature. Celebrate peace and quiet. Saves a lot of money, too. Not only are the media invoices over the last 3 weeks unbelievable, over $210,000, $70,000 a week, $10,000 a day. Yes, there were some generous sponsors for centennial stuff. What if they had been encouraged instead to support permanent park improvements? Those ad dollars could have done the same. Lots and lots of anniversaries this year from public entities to furniture stores. Contrast that with the excitement the solar eclipse is generating. Over $120,000 in startup equipment and supplies for Edgewater Beach House, not including small bears. Please don't dismiss that as merely a one-time expense. It's still part of the cost of doing business, paid for with real money, As we have seen with Merlin's Wharf, sometimes there are repeated do-overs of these startups. Surprising to learn that Whiskey Island Marina was restored prior to MetroPark's takeover using FEMA funds from Superstorm Sandy, but done without the required fire suppression. How was that permitted? The boat fire at Cedar Point this week shows the risks which apparently have been allowed to exist here for the past 4 years. It's not other people's money. It's our money being poorly allocated, so more of our money is needed later. It is remarkable how much was accomplished and preserved, and how much knowledge and appreciation was shared through the decades with far more limited funds. How much did the Centennial Picnic actually net for Cleveland Metro Park's trees? Or did all those expenses just divert money from the everyday park? Stinchcomb preserved the Valley Vistas until Brickman was allowed to clear them for his personal gain, a sad centennial note. Let's be sure the next 100 years does not undo the last century. Honoring the past is the best tribute. And I will add that John Kroc absolutely epitomizes that. He has dedicated his life to taking care of this park and making Metro Parks what it is, and I personally thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
Two things, I'll be very brief. First and foremost, as a cyclist and someone that speaks to a lot of people who ride, we've all noticed the electronic billboards in Mill Stream Run saying, please give bikes free to people in passing. It's a new state law that a lot of people aren't aware of, and seeing the Metro Parks take a leadership role in educating motorists is really to be applauded, and I know a lot of people appreciate that. I don't know what feedback you've been hearing, but everyone I speak to is thrilled to see that kind of information out there for motorists ahead of the travel part of the park. Secondly, we're fully into mountain bike season now, and I applaud the expansion of trails over the last several years from 2 to 22 miles. I think it's all agreed that it's been a resounding success and brings a lot of people to the park. There is an opportunity, I think, perhaps next time trails are on the docket for expansion, to take another look at the original plans of the Ohara Erie Canal Reservation. Currently we have 2.2 miles, I believe. Years ago, I believe the plan was to have that be a 6 mile trail. 5 or 6 miles is kind of the break point for what people consider worthwhile traveling to. And it's a great trail that's a lot of fun, right in the heart of the city that's accessible by bike. You don't have to get on a car to get to it. And it's a heavily populated area, especially among low-income people that might actually enjoy the park if they have an opportunity to go there and do something with it. So next time we're looking at trails, next time Ralph is on looking at expanding, please take another look at the O&E. It's a lot of fun, it's really close to the city, and I think it would be a real valuable resource to be expanded. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll commend your comments to Commissioner. Anyone else? Good.
We'll move into the information briefing items. With us this morning, we have one employee guest, Kelly Denden-Hoover, Zoo Education Specialist.
Morning, Brian. Morning, Commissioners. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Kelly Denden-Hoover. She is Zoo Education Specialist, and she has a unique role within the zoo. She manages a small team of staff and volunteers to take care of our program animal collections. These are the education animals that you see in our shows, in someone's hand as guests are coming in to, for an event, those sorts of things. So she's come to us with a variety of zoo experiences, and she's also been put into a role that's been a little bit challenging because education animals historically were sort of kept in a lab cage, brought out, shown to people for a couple minutes, and then put back in the lab cage. And we've been evolving that to a much more complicated animal management system, enrichment, training, exercise, this whole thing. And Kelly's been at ground zero and implementing that with our staff. So I really appreciate her efforts, and she's been a real value to us coming on board.
Yeah, well, I've been here for about a year now. I've loved working for the Metro Parks. It's a really, really great organization to be a part of. And I moved to Strongsville when I got here from Minnesota, so I got to be right down at the parks down there. And I'm Lakewood enjoying the Metro Parks up there as well, and a block from Rock River. So I've taking my bike out there and everything. So it's been a great opportunity to be a part of it, and I'm looking forward to the direction that the Ambassador Animals Program is moving to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next information item we have is what I would call, again, an evolution of park space, green space, the amusement parks, including the metro parks. Judy?
Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning, everybody. So I thought I would spend a few moments at the end of the summer talking about amusement parks, or what used to be amusement parks that are now part of the Cleveland Metro Parks. And am I doing this one right?
This is amusing.
How amusing can we be? Yes. Technology, yes. Okay. So a little bit of background about amusement parks in general. They were very, very popular at the turn of the last century and the beginning of the 20th century. Part of that driven by a few things, the invention of the use of electricity, machinery that could create these crazy rides that people like to ride on, though nothing like we have today, of course. And then also leisure time, an invention, if you will, of the 8-hour workday and the 40-hour work week gave people more leisure time to enjoy these kinds of places. The iconic one was Coney Island in New York, but that soon became imitated all over the country, including right here in Cleveland. One of the first amusement parks in Cleveland, long forgotten by many people, or most people I would say in the Cleveland area, was Scenic Park. So what I've done with these is I've kind of put us in a place where we are today. So this is Scenic Park, where the Emerald Necklace Marina is now today located. But a little over 100 years ago, it looked something like this. Now, Scenic Park never had the big rides like we are used to at Cedar Point, for instance. It wasn't in existence that long for various reasons, many of them financial troubles. But it had something that, the reason it was called Scenic Park, it had the first roller coaster in Cleveland area. Now this roller coaster, as you can see from this picture, and I apologize, it's a little fuzzy because it comes from a book, but this is called the tunnel in the roller coaster. It was kind of like a theme ride. You went into a tunnel, and as the wheels on the track were activated lights, which would light up various scenes so you could take a tour around the world. Port Arthur over in the Philippine Islands was an important place in those days, and that's where people liked to go see. And oh, they had like the burning of Pompeii and all kinds of crazy stuff. So this was a scenic railroad, not only a roller coaster, but a scenic railroad, hence the name Scenic Park, not because of the beautiful view that we enjoy down there. This is one of the few pictures of what it looked like. All of these amusement parks also had, of course, dance pavilions. That was actually the big draw for many of them in the early days. The rides were kind of secondary to the people that came there to dance and later roller skate. So this is what it looked like then. And this is what it looked like as it started to decline a little bit. You can't read this very well, but notice if you could, it says Lincoln Park. That's because as Scenic Park changed hands and went into a different group of owners, they were going to call it Lincoln Park. The park, beautiful, look at all these plants. This is 1906. It was going to be the best amusement park in Ohio, they were claiming. All kinds of things. By 1907, they were bankrupt. So eventually this land ended up in the city of Lakewood's bit of land, and then they sold it to Cleveland Metro Parks. Now, I said they had the first roller coaster, and actually, in my mind, they were kind of the first amusement park, but this place actually claims to be the first amusement park in Cleveland because it's from the 1880s. This is Bailey's Park. This is Washington Reservation. This is the first ski program. That's our Washington Park Reservation. This is a historian's nightmare, trying to find out about this park, because not only are a lot of the documentation of this park missing, just gone, doesn't exist, is very hard to find, but the whole area is different. You cannot tell from this map, of course, because it's not topographical, but this was a big ravine. This road coming out here from Square, this was a bridge. It was very, very high. Went over this man-made lake. This was all down in a ravine. It has since been filled in. There's no clue to any of us today that this was a ravine. And it used to have a lake. There's the lake. There's the bridge. Famous for collapsing one time in 1889. And so Bailey, who was the first owner, kind of lost his park over that. And it became Forest City Park and was, for a brief time, merry-go-rounds and a couple rides and so forth. And then the Humphreys took it over. The Humphreys, who owned Euclid Beach, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Well, Humphrey was famous for no alcohol in his parks. This neighborhood did not like that. So after he took it over, they stopped kind of going to this park. And it kind of disappeared. And as I said, it supposedly had a fire in 1917. You cannot find any documentation of that fire. But this is the one cool picture I love. This is their dance pavilion. It looks like the Addams family lives there. Wow. So, and when the city took over the southern part of this area and called it Washington Park, they also started to buy Forest City Park, and the idea was there was going to be 3-cent dances there, because that's what the dance pavilions in the city parks were offering. So you paid 3 cents a day. I'm sorry, Mr. Rinker.
It was exorbitant
fee to dance. Yeah, one dance. That's not to go in and dance all evening. So Forest City Park kind of disappeared from view. And the next one we're going to talk about is over on the west side. So this is Puritas Springs. Now, I'm fudging this a little. It is actually, of course, this is not Metro Parks land now. We're here. But the reason will become obvious why I consider this part of Cleveland Metro Park's amusement park background. Puritas Springs, as the name might imply, originally started as there was a spring up there doing some spring water. They were bottling water, and then it became what's called a trolley park, amusement park. A lot of these amusement parks were put at the end of the lines of the trolleys, and it helped people to come out, especially not during the weekdays, come out and use the trolleys and come out to the parks and go for, this one was very famous for roller skating and dancing and then rides. And eventually a particular ride became part of Puritas Springs, and it was called the Cyclone. It was a roller coaster erected in 1928. It was supposed to be the highest, fastest roller coaster in the country. And it was, whoops, I'm so sorry. It was right there where that arrow is. So you can see this roller coaster went down into the Cleveland Metro Parks area. That's why I included it. It was rumored to have people dying on it. It was so scary. It never did. Though people did get backaches from it because it was an old rickety wooden one. But the Cyclone, 1928 till 1959, was a favorite West Side ride. There's a picture of it there. And there's how it went down into the park area. I am told up behind Mastic Woods Golf Course that you could still find remnants of this roller coaster. I would imagine you could. It disappeared in 1959, so it's not that long ago. Though little by little, it's eroding away into the ground.
It's still there. There's some end buttons to the roller coaster.
Are still in there? Okay. All right. I one of these days I'm going to walk around back there and try to find it. I have a thing in my mind that 10,000 years from now, when nobody knows what amusement parks were, archaeologists are going to find these things and try to figure out what they were used for. Were they some religious temples or what? I don't know. or torture instruments. So finally we come to Euclid Beach. Of course, this is of all the amusement parks that now are part of Cleveland Metro Parks. This was the most beloved and the most memorable to those of us of a certain age who can still remember it. And I was a little girl. And Euclid Beach, of course, the original draw was the beach there. And it was built up along the beach, first a dance hall, and you know then the rides, little by little. This map is from 1932 because it's the latest one that we have. I don't have actually what it looked like in its heyday, which I would say the 40s, 50s, and 60s, just before it closed, are what most people remember. We have the Euclid Beach Boys, and they're like, you know, well, we, you know, the so-and-so ride was here, the so-and-so ride was here, but that changed over the years, of course. So Euclid Beach was very, very popular for many, many years, and I would say the rise of the amusement parks that are theme parks like Disney and so forth helped to demolish this. Cedar Point started putting higher and faster roller coasters, and eventually in 1968, Euclid Beach closed for the season, or 1969, I think it was, when it closed. So it was a very, very popular place along the years. This is its iconic entrance, which is still there. The Humphrey Asbury family, as I said earlier, they really made Euclid Beach what it was. The amusement parks at the turn of the last century were kind of rowdy places. The Humphreys said, no, let's make them family friendly. They allowed no alcohol. They didn't charge to get in. You could come in for free, but you bought tickets for each ride. And you had no money. You had to buy tickets for rides and for food. But the Humphreys actually started out as a candy and popcorn maker down in Public Square. So that's really how they got their foot in the door here as concessionaires, and then ended up buying it and running the place for years and years. I've had the privilege of talking to Dudley Humphrey III, who is a very delightful man, and said he remembers growing up there because they lived right by the park and being terrified of Laughing Sal, if any of you remember Laughing Sal. Said he would avoid the whole area of the park where she was at. These are some of the rides. There were hundreds of them. These are just some of the few rides that were at Euclid Beach. The iconic one, the rocket ships, for some reason I don't have a picture of them in operation, and though you will see them around town driving on wheels now. But all of these amusement parks started out as places because of the scenery on them, the beach, the river, whatever was nearby, the green grass, the trees. And so I would say that what we're doing now to return these areas to places where people can go and enjoy the natural beauty of them is just as important as all those rides that we enjoyed for all those years. Thank you.
That was the last information briefing item. We do have no old business to discuss at this time. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, September 7th. We do have an executive session.
Is there a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of discussing employment matters, specifically personnel?
So moved.
Seconded. Roll call.
Bruce Raker?
Aye.
Debbie Baird?
Yes.
We conduct no more business. You're welcome to stick around, but otherwise, enjoy the day. Oh, yeah, don't forget, 8:00 to 11:00.